Hi, and welcome to the Man Down podcast, the podcast where we talk all things men's mental health, masculinity, vulnerability, and everything in between. From guest interviews with inspirational individuals sharing their own vulnerabilities, through to the breakdown, where we break down different types of mental health support so that you can make the most educated and best informed decision possible to get help for yourself. As Matt Haig says, man up is not a call to strength, it's a demand of weakness. And the time for man up is over. This is Man Down. Welcome to episode 50 of the Man Down podcast with Andrew Waddell. Andrew and I talk about his work as the midlife coach, where he specializes in supporting men struggling with stuckness in their midlife. We also talk about his mental health, fatherhood, leaving the corporate world, and so much more. I hope you enjoy it. I am incredibly proud to say that Man Down is brought to you in partnership with Better, a charity raising awareness around mental health and suicide prevention through a range of exciting events and initiatives. Please head over to www.better.org.uk, that's B-E-D-E-R, or find them on Instagram at better_UK. So Andrew, thank you so much for joining me. How are you? How's everything going?
Yeah, things are good, thanks. Kind of that weirdly British thing where you try and play everything down, but actually things are good, yeah. Been away for a few days, had a lovely walk on Hampstead Heath this morning with my four-month-old puppy. So yeah, life is treating me well at the moment. I can't complain.
Good, glad to hear it. What kind of dog, if people at home are interested, I don't really mind because I want to know. So what kind of dog have you got?
She's a beautiful little Cocker Spaniel, golden Cocker Spaniel. Very, very sweet natured, very loyal. She's currently sleeping on my feet, which I hope she'll do for the next hour or so. But yeah, she's lovely. We would keep joking that she's a lockdown puppy bought too late as we exit lockdown, but actually it's fine with the summer here. Get outside, get some fresh air. Yeah. It's very nice.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. And how has the last, where are we now? We're middle of June. How has the last 14 months been for you? What's the world look like for yourself?
I mean, it's been one of, total change. I think it's been, especially for society, it's been such a massive change, but I mean, personally, huge change. I left the corporate world after 20 plus years. That rediscovery of what it's like to be a dad, which has been amazing, taking the kids to school for the first time in 11 years. So it's had massive upsides, and it feels really bad saying that. We know that last 40 months has been one of people having massive extremes. And I think you have to be very grateful if you're one of the ones who got out of it, with family untouched by COVID, which I have been. And actually a chance to really reassess life, get off the treadmill, be at home. And I love being at home, got two boys, love being with them. So it's been good, but it has been change, and big kind of reassessment of life. But I think what this has taught all of us, I hope, is that, change is possible. All that stuff we thought we couldn't do 14 months ago, all those companies that said you had to be here 24/7 to man the desk, man the phones, be there for your clients, we've all succeeded in making change happen that no one said could happen. So I think I come out of it with a degree of optimism for the future, actually, that I think maybe we've recognized some really important lessons around, the importance of life as opposed to work.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. I think there have been some, the clear and obvious negatives that it does make it difficult to say that there have been positives, whether it's personally or whether it's on a wider scale. But there definitely have been, especially from a work perspective, a lot of positive takeaways from the experience. And you touched on there, leaving the corporate world after 20 odd years, and people will have heard a bit of an introduction before we started the episode, but from your own side of things, what is it that you do?
So I mean, 20 plus years spent in advertising and marketing, and a big journey, and a journey I think of discovering maybe that I didn't love advertising and marketing, but it took me an awfully long time to figure it out that actually it wasn't where my heart lay, but also recognizing that there were bits of it that I loved, the people being the heart of it, the creativity, the curiosity. But then since leaving that world, you know, I had this real desire to, I guess, give something back. I'm big fan of the English language and the word generativity, which is kind of linked really to midlife. And it's all about this idea that it's the movement from self, putting me first, to the recognition that you want to give something back, you know, this need to nurture and guide the next generation, and not necessarily linked to fatherhood particularly, they obviously that plays a part in it, but this really, this sense, I guess, a legacy maybe, but I think that sounds too grandiose. It's more, I guess, a sense of just recognizing you're part of this enormous, you know, planet and this human race, and actually, you know, your part to play in it is not just about you. And so from the back of that, you know, really, really focusing in on what I could do. And I think at that point, you know, the midlife coach came out of that idea that, you know, speaking to my own experiences of midlife, the struggles that I had, the experiences I had, and this real fundamental belief I have that men need to talk to men. You know, that it's the male voice that needs to be heard by other men, whether that's talking about vulnerability or emotions or needs or fears. There's still too much silence around the male voice. And I think possibly even increasingly silence around the male voices. You know, the emphasis moves rightly in many cases to women and female empowerment. There's a danger. The flip side is that men feel even less able or allowed to speak up, and for me, I felt like I had an opportunity to speak up. So that was kind of the goal.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think it's very necessary. And interestingly, I think this is probably just by nature of the work that I've done today and the people that I've met. Most of my guests, I would say, are pre-midlife, and in absolutely no disrespect whatsoever, you are older than most of my guests. And I think it actually provides such an interesting perspective and such an interesting and valuable take on things, because, you know, there's lots of shared experiences between men of similar ages, but also a lot of shared experiences of men of all ages. And I think, you know, in the stats that we see around male suicide and male mental health, a lot of it covers huge age ranges and not just specific portions. So there must be almost something symptomatic of the male experience, the experience of being a man, that feeds through all of that. So I think it's important to get, you know, your perspective and the work that you're doing, I think, is so, so vital. And within the midlife coach, what does that look like? What is your, I suppose, your way of working with people and with, you know, whoever it is you're working with, what does that actually look like? What is your goal? What is your kind of mission with the work that you do?
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing is to kick off with, you know, what is the experience? You know, what are the who are the people who feel that they need that help and I guess come looking, because that's as much of anything. And for me, it's all wrapped up in this idea of stuckness. You know, we're not talking about depression in its purest form, in terms of a diagnosable depression. We're talking about, actually, I think Adam Grant, that, you know, wrote in the New York Times a couple of months ago about this great term, languishing, which is this idea, which is the middle state between depression on the one side of the sort of the mental health spectrum and flourishing on the other end. Languishing sits in the middle, and he was talking about it with reference to the COVID experience, the pandemic, the being in lockdown, and how many people are feeling that sense of apathy, energyless, lack of direction. But when he wrote about it, I felt like that was a really good word for midlife, you know, because it's not a case of, it's almost not an active state. It's almost a passive state of compromise over choice, of feeling trapped, of feeling like you're not living to your values anymore. You've lost sight of your purpose. And it can be very hard to recognize that is a state that, you know, exists and you're experiencing. So that's kind of the clients who come to me very much are in that state of mind. And it's one that I was very familiar with when I turned 40, so 6 years ago. And then in terms of what we talk about, it's all client-led. You know, I come from a transformational coaching background, which fundamentally believes that everybody has the ability to define their own future, define their own needs, define their own purpose, but they need support in doing that. And the Midlife Coach program is really based around the key pillars that I believe are fundamental to figuring out, you know, what you want to do with the second half of your life. And they are values. You know, I think I can't talk enough about the importance of recognizing core values and living to those values and recognizing where you're being compromised against those values. It focuses on limiting beliefs, how we establish these narratives that really hold us in place, and the assumption that we can't do things and rather than what we can do. And then a focus after that on, you know, on purpose. I mean, purpose is an overused word, I think, and it's become a bit of a corporate sort of, you know, I don't know, flag that says, you know, we believe in purpose. But individual purpose, I think, is really important. You know, we're living in a country where the majority of people don't have a religion, aren't religious. What is the purpose that's driving us? Why are we here? What are we trying to look at? Because otherwise, how do you measure fulfillment if you don't know what you're trying to measure it against? And then after that, it's about the stepping stones. It's about behavior change. It's about identifying where we can take action and be proactive in defining our future as opposed to feeling like we're just being pushed into corners. So it's a process, and it's a lot of conversation and a lot of questions, and a lot of opportunity to, it's a great phrase that actually my life coach from many years ago used, which is play with the possibility. It's how do we allow ourselves the room to be creative without allowing our critical inner voice, you know, Freud's superego, how do we stop that telling us that we're being stupid, that we're being ridiculous, that we can't do it? How do we create a space in which we can play with the idea of doing something different and let it live with us for a bit before committing? And so that's a lot of what we're doing, is creating this space, a reflective space, yes, but a creative space fundamentally to kind of invent the future.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it actually reminds me, I'm about halfway through listening to a 4.5-hour podcast, and I don't think I ever have any desire to record a 4.5-hour podcast. It's an episode of the Aubrey Marcus podcast, which I love, and he's talking to probably one of my favorite academics. I think he would probably call himself an academic, a guy called Jamie Weil, and he talks a lot in his new book about meaning 1.0 and meaning 2.0, and it comes back to that point you're making around purpose, because meaning 1.0 was, you know, organized religion, majority of people have some form of religion that gives them meaning, that gives them purpose, because there is heaven or there is an afterlife or there is reincarnation, whatever it might be. And now the fastest growing and biggest proportion of people are non-religious, be that atheist, be that spiritual, without religion, be that whatever. And all of a sudden it's how do we find meaning and how do we find purpose? And I think there is a real case of languishing, because I love that term and that article, within that realm of purpose and people seeking purpose and looking for purpose, and because it is such a buzzword, almost being slapped in the face with their lack of purpose because everybody's talking about it.
I'm a fan of your sports fan. I know, but I'm a fan of sort of the idea of having swing thoughts. So a lot of the stuff I do with my clients is how do you build up those swing thoughts that kind of allow you to take a moment, take the third position, step back. And one of those for me is equanimity. You know, this idea of trying to find calmness and composure in the middle of it, not reacting to the storm, but being in it, but able to let it sort of pass through you. And it's an incredibly hard thing to do in the chaos and the helter-skelter of life, to just pause for a second and assess it. And I think, you know, purpose and values are part of that process. If you haven't figured out and worked back to your core values and your purpose, then in that moment of storm, you can't step back and ground yourself in anything. And I think certainly for me and, you know, my experience of turning 40 in the years that followed that, and having an emotional breakdown off the back of that, you know, I think I lost sight a lot of what my values were. And you know, trying to live a life that was being, that you thought was the one you should be doing, and that other people expected of you as opposed to what you needed. And so in the calm, you just didn't reflect as you needed to. You didn't build, you didn't grow, you just got back into it. And I think, you know, it staggers me how the years can pass and pass and pass, and the cycle just repeats and repeats and repeats. And, you know, those moments when you're in control and it's calm, you almost just passively exist because that's enough, as opposed to using that moment to kind of to reassess. And I think, you know, as I say, the last year has allowed a lot of people in maybe in that corporate commuting treadmill to step off that treadmill for a minute. It's almost forced a pause. It's forced a reassessment of the work-life balance, because the work-life balance happened literally in your home. You know, when you close the door from your study, your living room, your kitchen, that was the work-life balance in place. And they recognize how the balance had lost its focus, lost its you know, equilibrium. I don't know if it's a societal state, you know, if we're in the era of this, of purpose, the era of meaning. But certainly it feels like a lot of people are struggling, and a lot of people are still not necessarily sharing that struggle. And I think for me, that's kind of, I was summed up by my therapist suggested a book to read by a guy called James Hollis, who's an American Jungian psychoanalyst. He's written loads of books, but he wrote this one called The Middle Passage: From Misery to Meaning in Midlife. And it really spoke to me, because he talked about how men collude in a conspiracy of silence whose aim is to suppress their emotional truth. And for me, that was just felt so true, that it's the men who are stopping the other men from speaking. And this collusion that we're all coping, this collusion that we're not emotional animals, that we're somehow able to compartmentalize, we're somehow able to exist at a higher plane, there's an arrogance to it, and there's a deep fear behind that arrogance. And I think we're also learning, you know, this is a generation that are learning how to do it as men. I remember listening to Simon Pegg's Desert Island Discs, Simon Pegg, the actor, a year or so ago. I love Simon Pegg. I think he's a very, very funny guy. But he made this really astute kind of observation. He was asked one of those sort of classic celebrity kind of questions, which is, what sort of dad are you? You know, like he's going to be able to sum up all of fatherhood as a Hollywood actor. He's going to be able to. But actually what he said was incredibly profound to me anyway, because he said... He goes, I'm both a good father and a bad father, but I'm a learning father, because I'm trying to be a father that I never had. And we're the first generation, he said, of fathers who are trying to figure out a different way of doing it, a way of emotionally bonding with our children. And we didn't necessarily have that. And I certainly didn't have that growing up. And so we're going to make mistakes, and we're going to get frustrated, and we're going to feel like we're failing, but at least we're trying, you know, at least we're the first ones to say, okay, there's a different way of doing it. And of course, that's a massive generalization, but I think it's a true generalization for a lot of people who are in their mid 40s, 50s now as fathers, who are trying to figure out how to be a better father, a more involved father. And that speaks back to the generativity, again, this idea of, you know, what are we leaving behind? Let's not leave damage behind. You know, let's try and lead boys who are going to turn into men who are able to talk an emotional truth. And I think, you know, for me, if that's a legacy, that'd be a pretty profound legacy.
I totally agree. And it's actually really, I think, refreshing and reassuring to hear as well, because I definitely, as someone who hasn't quite got friends who are stepping into fatherhood just yet, but maybe a couple of people who are on the fringes of it. And it's something that I know, you know, I myself, if as when I become a father, it's definitely something that I'm fairly determined to do. But it's amazing to hear that, you know, there are people such as yourself kind of already doing that work. And I love that quote from, was it James Hollis? That for me sums up so much of these conversations and the work that we do, because there is this fear, and the number of times you hear about, you know, and I can speak for myself and other people that I know, where the person that you end up speaking to about your struggle or what you're going through tends to be a partner or a mother or a female of some kind in your life that you trust. It's rarely a father or a brother or a male friend. It just, it, there is that distrust, there's that fear. Yeah. I think it's that fear of being exposed, that fear of weakness to another man, in that it might be, you know, used against you in some way, I think, a lot of the time. So yeah, I think it's such an important piece. And I think around fatherhood as well, it is, that's how we change it, is raising the next generation differently and doing things differently. And as you rightly said, there will be mistakes as a part of that. And I think that's a really, again, a really important point. And it's something I've discussed quite a lot around feminism generally, is that a lot of men are fearful of getting involved in the discussion because they're fearful of saying the wrong thing. But we're always going to say the wrong thing when we're learning. So being allowed to make those mistakes and learn from those mistakes, I think, is such an important part of the process. Do you find in your work and with the people that you work with, that is there ever a sense of it's too late for me to change? It's too late for me to start. It's I'm too far down this road into my career, into my family, to do anything differently. Is that a sentiment you see a lot of?
I mean, definitely, 100%. And I had it as well. You know, more often than not, it's linked to career and income. So there's a lot of that sense of, you know, I've established this career, I'm being paid this amount of money, which I need for our family to live to the standard that we're living to. How can I possibly move career, change focus into something where I don't earn as much money? How can I do that? I've got a job to do, and that job is providing. Now, of course, you know, the majority of families out there will have a dual income, but still, we are in a world where we know men are paid more than women, and so for the man to suddenly not have an income will have an impact on the majority of households. But it's also a convenience, you know, it is also a self-fulfilling sort of prophecy. And I think there's a really interesting model called the immunization to change, which is fundamentally that whenever you see a resistance to change, you have to ask the question, what is being protected by that resistance to change? So the behaviors we put in place are all there to save us in some way from facing something. And, you know, usually what I find when I talk to people, that, and again, I had this myself, is what the fear is I don't know what I want to do. You know, the number of people who are in their midlife who aren't working to some career dream, they didn't head up that career ladder with any degree of real purpose apart from earning a bit more money, you know, maybe attaining some job titles. But it wasn't the thing that they dreamt about as a child. It wasn't even the thing they dreamt about, you know, growing up and maybe being at college or university. It was something they fell into for whatever reasons, be it a sense of, you know, family pressure, societal pressure, whatever it might be, or just need, plain and simple need. And the problem is they simply don't actually know what they could do or would do or want to do. And so a lot of the process, again, is breaking it back down to the fundamentals of what you enjoy doing, what gives you energy as opposed to removes your energy. Where do you find your passion? And they sound like such simple questions, but so many people can't answer them without some really reflective work, some real kind of returning to childhood, to what the drivers were when they were growing up, and stripping away some of the critical inner voice that stops them even thinking about what they could do in the first place. You know, so often I hear that, but I couldn't do that because that's ridiculous. But actually what they're doing is something that other people do. You know, it's not that it's not flying to Mars. It's as straightforward as running a small business or, you know, setting up something that they have a passion for. So other people are doing it. It's not impossible to do. It just feels like an impossible step because of the obstacles they're putting in their way. Now, that's not to negate the fact that, of course, change is hard. And, you know, for me this last year, I've, you know, walked away from a very good salary in an advertising agency. I'm not earning anywhere near as much money as I was earning. But for me, the balance in terms of the time I'm spending with my kids, the fact that I'm involved in their lives in a way I wasn't for a decade, the satisfaction I have from that, the satisfaction in the work I'm doing, and the fact that it's based on what I believe in, and I'm able to be authentic to that and not have to subscribe to someone else's vision of what I should be, makes it worthwhile. And will there be tough times? Or will there be a tightening of belts? Well, there absolutely is, without a doubt. But I think people beginning to recognize, or are starting to recognize, that that is a better measure of fulfillment than, you know, not even just more income, but a title, or just sort of sticking with it, like maybe our dads did, just stick with it for 40 years in a career that they hated, you know, and that was kind of just the expectation. We have an opportunity now to break that expectation. But you have to, first of all, re-engage with curiosity in yourself, and you have to re-engage with creativity. What could I do? What might I do? What might I enjoy doing? Not ridicule it as being ridiculous, but let's see if I could build something around the stuff I have passion for and gives me energy, as opposed to starting from, well, I've got to earn this much money. What could I do that earns this much money? But it's difficult. So yeah, absolutely. A lot of people will say it's too late for me. Interestingly, and one of the big sort of eye openers for me since setting up the Midlife Coach, is that 2/3 of the people who approach me are women, and they're approaching me on behalf of their partner, not having spoken to their partner, but because they recognize in what I'm talking about, they recognize their partner in that. And that's why I feel it's so important for me to share my own experiences. And I'm very open about those in my website, etc. Because it's the language that they recognize. And I recently did a video with my wife, Thalia, talking around her experience of my turning 40 and my breakdown. And the amount of people who came off that saying, I recognize this in my husband, boyfriend, partner. I can sense that apathy. I can sense that frustration that's coming out as anger towards the kids. I can sense that lack of passion for what they're doing and that sense of trappedness. I think that they need your help now, which is fantastic. Equally, you can only take a horse to water, as they say. So there's still that challenge of making, of allowing someone to recognize that they need that help. And I'm a big believer that, you know, you can only recognize the change that you're committed to finding. You know, coaching, like any other, like therapy, like anything else, is not a some sort of primary school academic course where you're told the answers. You know, it's really hard work. It requires a lot of self-reflection. It requires time. I know when I was in therapy, it was a very tough time for my wife, that I was very absent for that period of time because I needed to put all of my energy into that work. Yeah, that was the work that I was doing, was in myself. And there had to be an investment in that to make it worthwhile. And I think coaching is the same thing. You have to invest the time and the energy in it. If you go into it believing that the coach is going to come up with the answer for you, then I think it's destined to failure. So that's one of the challenges. But it's interesting. I think that there's an absolute part to play in this alliance between men and women on both sides, that is true also of sort of this, I guess, breaking down the cliche of the midlife crisis. You know, there's a degree to which men have created the myth of the midlife crisis, this idea of fast cars and affairs. Almost that has been taken on by women as the joke, because it's the fear as well, that I'm going to be left for some 20-year-old because my husband's going through this ridiculous midlife crisis. And actually breaking that down to the real lived experience that is just one of unhappiness, you know, and stuckness. And if nothing is done about it, then it can obviously manifest itself in bad choices, for sure. And actually the way to sort to get, you know, to preempt that is to have these conversations, to recognize when that anger and frustration is coming from a place of stuckness and not from a place of, you know, testosterone.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I think coming back to a point or a question I made earlier, there is just seemingly this incredibly common experience. And I think across people, but I think especially across men, in that a lot of the times where we're suffering or we're feeling stuck or we're languishing or whatever it might be, it's the times where we're not being honest with ourselves, or we've built a habit of dishonesty with ourselves. And I think that is, you know, a lot of what you've described and how you work with people and the processes and how it all fits together comes from ultimately, and this is sort of something I've landed on quite recently in my own work, is it all stems from this principle of self-inquiry and asking, you know, what actually is it that I love? What is it really? If I strip everything away, if I can step out of the the life that I've lived for the last 30 years and think what brings me joy and what you know, sparks excitement and happiness. And as you said, gives me energy rather than sucks it out of me. I think that's the thing. It's actually that radical self-honesty, which allows you to open up to other people, but also you have to go through that yourself, because if you have spent 30 years lying to yourself in sort of no uncertain terms, then you have to undo that. And because you'll have gotten so good at repeating the lies that they almost seem true. So I think there is a real process there to go through. And interestingly as well, around the piece around partners and girlfriends and wives coming to you, it's so interesting, because it fills me with confidence to a certain extent, because 50% of my listeners are female, and I always wondered why. And it's because, and I actually asked sort of an open question to anybody who listens, being like, if you are female, thank you for listening, but why? Like, what is the purpose? What are you listening for? And every single answer I got was so that I can help the men in my life better, and so I can understand what the men in my life are going through. And there is a real feminine quality to that, which I think drives some real important changes. And I think that is why we end up seeing so many men opening up to partners and opening up to mothers around this stuff, because there is a natural feminine energy type quality to being able to understand that and being able to help and hold space for that. So there's, I'd be amiss to miss the part where we talk about your own journey, because I think as you've mentioned it informs so much of the work that you do, and you've alluded to some of your, you know, your experience of leaving your job, turning 40, having a breakdown. But what did that look like? What was that, I suppose, that process for you? What was that journey?
Yeah, I mean, so for me, my wife would say that I've broadly had a kind of midlife crisis every decade I turned. I'm one of those people who don't like aging. I don't like birthdays particularly. I certainly don't like, you know, I didn't like turning 30. Certainly didn't look forward to turning 40. But I was in a very good place. I had a great 30s. I was in a very good place, career-wise, family-wise. I was very, you know, quote, happy, I thought. Turned 40 with a degree of reticence. And then my dad died 6 months after that, after a couple of years battling cancer, but quite suddenly. And I did what men do around grief, which was that I compartmentalized it. And I got stuck into work. I think I did I was asked to do a pitch about 4 weeks after his funeral. And yeah, in the advertising world, pitches are full on, you know, they're a serious investment of time and weekends, and you know that going to them. And I said, absolutely. And it was coming up to Christmas, and I did this big pitch, and then I did another pitch straight after Christmas. And I did not think I was, you know, I thought I was a pretty self-aware, you know, aware to my emotions kind of guy. And yet I still managed to fulfill all of those kind of male cliches of burying myself in the work and not grieving, not giving the grief a space. But I'm a big believer that we have a capacity, you know, for emotional trauma in our lives. You know, each of us has a, you know, call it a reservoir, if you will, yeah, which is filled up over time. And, you know, at some point, if you don't kind of deal with it, drain it, you know, figure it out, it will burst the dam. And often the bit that bursts it is not what filled it. So for me, it was actually a couple of years after my dad died. I'm lucky that I've been given kind of 6 weeks off work. I'd been there for 10 years. We had a thing where I got 6 weeks off. We had this amazing trip to Canada. And I thought I was so relaxed. I was, you know, the best I'd ever been, so relaxed. And got back and my kids had written a journal of the trip. And all the way through it, they referred to me as Mr. Angry. And I was kind of really surprised, because I thought I'd been, you know, so calm, so happy throughout this entire trip. Got back, immediately got headhunted for a CEO job of an agency, a competitor agency. I went straight into it without thinking about it, even though I'd wanted the 6 weeks away to be about reassessing what I did, knowing I was unhappy with the industry. I went straight for the CEO role. That was another 4 or 5 month process. And I can remember being in Cornwall on a beach when I got the call that I hadn't got the job. I'd got down to loss two, I'd had endless interviews, and I didn't get this job. And this massive mixture of emotions. I mean, just like a tsunami of different emotions, from gutted that I hadn't got it, this sense of real failure, real judgment that I was coming, second best, literally. Utter relief, this massive sense that I'd been saved from this thing that I really didn't want to do, but felt like I obliged to do, climbing this ladder further. I didn't have to do it. And this big relief. But then again, this guilt over feeling the relief. So real messed up. Got back to work, and a couple of months later, triggered by, the smallest of thing. I think I had an argument with somebody in the office, which was not something I did normally. One evening I went home and just totally broke down. And it started with a sort of innocuous conversation. And within a matter of sort of an hour, I was on the kitchen floor, really in pieces. And it was, everything. It was despair, grief, self-pity, anger, a lot of anger pouring out about everything, about the compromises I'd had to make. But it was pretty apparent to my wife, who was there with me, that I was in proper trouble. And she convinced me over the course of that night that I needed proper help. And then I went through that whole process of what do you do when you need help, and it's a confusing world out there. I love that you're doing the breakdown stuff that kind of talks about all of the different, support you can get, because if you've not engaged with it before, it's totally, mind-blowing. And there's something like 64 different types of psychoanalytic support you can get. It's like, where do you start? The CBTs. So I waded through that, and I was very lucky that I found a very, very good fit in terms of a therapist. Interestingly, a woman. Again, that sense of, women helping men. And that really, really started the journey. But it was a long journey. It took me a year and a half of therapy, followed by some real self-reflection to kind of figure my way through it, and to understand that there was a different future out there if I wanted to try and explore it. And then a real stage of creativity in terms of curiosity that ended up in me starting a master's in organizational psychology and group psychology, to try and understand human behavior within organizations and see if that was somewhere I could go. So that's sort of the other part of my business, is called Mind and Matter Consulting, and that's working with agencies to help them figure out how people fit within their system. How does the human psyche, especially at a group level, work within an organization? And that was the sort of the beginning of the healing. And I'm still on that process. The last year has been a lot of change, but that was the journey that I talked to people about. And it was probably about a year or so ago, I did my first talk around that experience within an agency, and shared it. And I was incredibly nervous doing it, but I was a senior person in the agency, sort of talking about therapy, trying to demystify and destigmatize therapy, talking to the truth around the, you touched on the horrendous statistics around male suicide, but really trying to make people aware of things. Because I think they bear repeating, right? I mean, leading cause of death in men under 35, an extraordinary statistic that's the case. 3 out of every 4 suicides. And then I think the one that obviously I became very aware of, which was that the higher suicide rate among men is between 45 and 49. And I was at that point, 45. And just that sense of like, it could have been me, and I unfortunately knew a couple of people who did commit suicide at that age. And in each case, it was totally unexpected, and family and friends did not see it coming. And it was not a mental illness. It was a culmination of life and an inability to cope, and sadly an inability to find the help they needed and the support they needed. And for me, that kind of all coalesced into this sense of, here's a role. There's a power in men talking openly about their feelings. It needs men to talk to other men about what they've been through. There's a great, are you a fan of The West Wing? Have you ever seen The West Wing?
I haven't actually, no.
There's a great story that one of the characters in The West Wing talks. He's talking to one of his colleagues who's struggling, actually with PTSD, I think. But he says, there's a man, and he falls down a hole, And he's in the bottom of the hole, and he looks up, and a priest walks past, and he says to the he says, "Father, I need your help." And the father says a prayer and writes a prayer down and throws it down into the hole. And then a bit of time passes, and he looks up, and a doctor walks past, and he says, "Hey, doctor, I'm down in this hole, and I need some help." And the doctor writes a prescription and throws it down into the hole. And time goes past, and the man looks up, and one of his friends walks past, and he says, "Hey, Joe, I'm down in this hole, and I need some help." And Joe jumps down into the hole, and the man says, "What are you doing, Joe? Now you're in the hole with me." And he says, "Yeah, but I've been in this hole before, and I know the way out." And for me, that sort of speaks to this whole sense of the lived experience, the partnering that needs to come. It needs men to talk to men, men to talk to boys around, you know, a different way of doing things, a different way of thinking, a different way of feeling, a different way of sharing. And for me, that starts with, you know, standing up and talking and sharing experiences and being open to that. And it's amazing how defensive some men can be about that. I got accused recently of doing it for the accolades, you know, that I wanted a medal for sharing my experiences. And it's very easy to feel guilt at that moment, to think, well, is it about that? Am I just seeking that recognition? But I think that's part of this collusion that James Hollis speaks about, this collusion that protects men who are scared of sharing their emotions from sharing their emotions. But I think those of us who feel like we can do that, feel like we are in a place and have an experience that is worth sharing and might help people, the more we do it, the more it'll change the narrative.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think I've been there myself plenty of times as to questioning my own motives for what I do, when that internal voice, that self-doubt, rears its head. And I think it's very easy to doubt yourself, as it is with all things. But I think with this especially, there's a real risk that you go, "Oh, okay, I'll just stop and let that fear, that collusion win." And I think I saw actually something that riled me earlier today from the wonderful moron that is Jeremy Clarkson. And he wrote in his Sunday Times column, "Spare me Keir Starmer's tears. Bottling it all up has never done me any harm." And it just speaks volumes, I think, unfortunately, to the issues that we see. And all you can do is laugh, but it is unfortunate that people are able to say that on a public stage, when it wasn't all that long ago that he was throwing punches at producers for not getting him the right steak. And, you know, he's clearly not quite got it all under his control as he thinks he does. So, it's a great point. I love that, that story from the West Wing as well, because I think it is the way to make change is to speak about these things. And I found it with my own story when I first started speaking to my oldest friends. It was within minutes that other people were saying, "Oh yeah, like I've actually been struggling with this as well." And I'm like, "Okay, great. Well, this is why we do this." So it's great to see and great to hear. And the last thing that I'd really like to touch on, and again, it sort of comes back to something we've touched on a little bit throughout the conversation, which is around fatherhood. Because as someone who has a father but is not a father, I'm intrigued as to how old are your boys?
So they're 11 and 9.
Okay. And for you in the work that you do, where does... I'm going to show my ignorance here, but you know, where do these kind of conversations feature with an 11 year old and a 9 year old? Is it something that you feel, is it more a case of leading by example in how you interact with your wife and how you interact with other people? Or is it you're actually more actively introducing them to, you know, the different way of being a boy, being a man?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And you know, going back to the Simon Pegg point, you know, it's an experiment with really important ramifications, because obviously you want the absolute best for your kids. And we're, you know, charting slightly uncharted territory, if that makes sense. So yeah, I think As the boys have got older, for me, all the way through, it was about making sure that we didn't suppress their emotions or in any way suggest that an emotion was inappropriate. And that goes for anger as well. I think, you know, I came from a background where anger was entirely repressed. That we were never angry as a family. There was no anger demonstrated. There were no raised voices, no swearing, no shouting. But of course, there was anger. But the anger was not acknowledged anyway, and that's left me with, you know, massive issues around conflict and avoidance of conflict. So, you know, recognizing with the boys that those emotions are natural, but mostly it's about, I think, creating a, you know, for me it's about creating an openness. So, you know, we talk about everything and anything, and you know, some of the things that my 11-year-old says certainly make you kind of sit back and go, wow, okay, I wasn't expecting that question. And it can be, in moments, it can be hard not judge, but to feel like you have to tell a certain narrative or explain it in a certain way. So a lot of it's just playing it back, which is where the coaching comes in. It's the open questions of, you know, how does this make you feel? You know, why do you feel like this might be it? So that they're explaining where it comes from, because, you know, especially at that kind of age, that sort of between, I guess, real childhood and teen years, there's so many thoughts, so many experiences, so many hormones rushing around that I think it's a very confusing and chaotic world. And then add in the last year of, you know, real unsettling and uncertainty. I think it's just about, you know, making a time to have a conversation. But I mean, you know, I'm absolutely loath to in any way be a spokesperson for How to Father, because I think, you know, you can only be the father that you feel you should be, and you can only, you know, be the father to your children that your children need as well. So my children are quite emotionally kind of aware, and they always have been. They've always been quite open to telling about how they feel, which is great. They're my youngest, less so than my eldest. And so we know we have to work with the youngest more to not let it bottle up. But, you know, you do what you can do, and you do what feels right. And you do, I guess, try and provide what you didn't maybe get yourself. Actually, there's another great James Hollis quote. I should probably give him some credit. He talks about, you know, about healing in men, and says, yeah, if men are going to heal, then they must activate within what they did not receive from without, which is this, you know, absolutely truth. Again, it's like, rather than feeling angry, you know, when my dad died, I had so much anger around what I didn't get, you know, that I didn't get told that he loved me, I didn't get told that he was proud of me, that those weren't words that he ever felt he could share with me. Not that I didn't feel he felt that, but he never wrote it down. He never spoke it, you know, despite having a terminal disease for sort of 2 years. It wasn't in his makeup to do that. And so for me, it's catching myself when I don't say something. Like, why am I not telling them that I'm proud? Why am I feeling like what they've done isn't good enough? Because that's on me, not on them. You know, so how can I express to them that what they're doing is good enough, you know, whilst also wanting the best for them and being aware that, you know, kids can be lazy as well and not focused and all the other stuff that, you know, you still have to, the discipline is still part of that and the expectation. But so it's a massive balancing act, I think. And this knowledge that, as I say, if you get it, you know, almost whatever you do will have its ramifications. And the best you can do, I think, is create a relationship of, you know, in which they can express what they're really feeling to you, even if at some point down the line, no doubt that will be, hate you, Dad. I'd rather that came out than didn't come out, you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. And then you can really rile them up being like, and why does it make you feel that way? And go, you can really go into your coaching therapist type role. But no, I think that's invaluable advice for anybody listening, because it ultimately comes down to, I suppose, fostering that culture of that relationship of openness, of comfort, of freedom to speak how you're really feeling, speak authentically, and also to come from a place of curiosity rather than, you know, judgment, to say, okay, oh, wasn't expecting that. I want to understand where that came from rather than purely a reactive, you know, response to what it was. And yeah, I think as you rightly said, and this is actually a conversation my girlfriend and I have had, is that, you know, we both want to be parents at some point, and we're there's part of us that's like, oh, like, yeah, we think we know what we'd do in that situation. But also, if you start overthinking it, there's ramifications, as you said, no matter what you do. So you've just got to do your best and accept that there will be mistakes, and really just, yeah, all you can do is your best at the end of the day, and really give what, yeah, as you said, what you don't have.
There's this moment when I think the kids are kind of two or three, when, yeah, you spend all this time as a new parents discussing what bits of yourselves your kids have, you know, obviously your eyes, your hair, but personality wise, or your stubbornness, or your physicality, or whatever it might be. And then you suddenly get to this point when you recognize that there are bits of them start to emerge that are needs of you. And you have this sudden realization that what you've created is not some weird hybrid, you know, monster of the best bits or the worst bits of yourselves. What you've created is something entirely unique that you need to listen to and learn from, because you don't, it's not something you necessarily understand. They don't think in the way that either one of you think or behave. And that's a real scary moment when you suddenly go, God, I've got to learn something here, something new, because it's not intuitive.
Yeah.
It's not from me. It's not how I would see the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't remember who it was, but I was listening to a podcast recently and they were talking about parenting, and someone said, well, okay, the conversation always comes back to, is it nature or nurture? And my answer is always yes. It's both. And it always comes back to that, you know, every child has a unique personality that they, you know, are born with. And then there are, you know, from the moment they're born, things being imprinted on them and conditioning and everything that comes with it. And it's just a mix of everything. And so, yeah, I guess it just comes down to doing your best and, yeah, being as curious as you can be. And I think that's a lovely place to wrap up. So Andrew, thank you so much for your time and for sharing all of the amazing things that you're doing. For people who want to find out more, you know, about the work that you do, either within organizations or with individuals, where's the best place to go for them?
So, I mean, I'm on LinkedIn and also on Facebook. So, you know, on my website's midlife-coach.co.uk. So, I'm in the usual places. If you search, you'll find me somewhere.
Perfect. Yeah, I will share that link in the episode description and any other relevant links so that people can find you, because I'm sure there are lots of people, probably partners of men, who might be getting in touch as we've discussed. Right. But yeah, thank you so much, Andrew. It was really, really enjoyable chat.
Well, thank you so much for having me on, Jamie. Really enjoyed it.
So that is it for today's episode of Man Down. Thank you so much for tuning in, as always. Tune in every Sunday for the next episode of Man Down with our next inspirational guest. If you want to get in touch, or if there's anyone that you think should be on the podcast, you can reach out directly on Instagram at jamie.clements_ or by email on jamie@mandownpod.co.uk.